time for a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper is an Israeli human rights activist, a retired anthropology professor, and presently is the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. In 2006, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by the American Friends Service Committee for his work, quote, to liberate both the Palestinian and the Israeli people from the yoke of structural violence and to build equality between their people by recognizing and celebrating their common humanity, end quote. He is the author of two books, Obstacles to Peace, a reframing of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and An Israeli in Palestine, Resisting Dispossession, Redeeming Israel. Jeff, thank you very much for coming and spending time
with us.
Thanks
for having me in.
Start out and tell us a bit about the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions.
We're one of the leading, I would say, modestly, peace and human rights organizations in Israel. We started about 13 years ago. I mean, I've been involved for 40 years in the Israeli peace movement. And during the Oslo peace process, during the 90s, the Israeli peace movement also, like other Israelis, invested a lot of hopes that maybe something's going to, you know, the sides are meeting, there's negotiations, maybe something will happen. In 1996, when Netanyahu was elected for the first time, Benjamin Netanyahu as Prime Minister of Israel, on an explicitly anti-peace process program, it was clear that the Oslo process was over, that Israel was not going to give up its occupation. In fact, during the 7 years of negotiations with the Palestinians between 1993 and 2000, Israel doubled its settler population to 400,000. So it was clear that Israel was not going to give up the occupation, especially with a right-wing government like Netanyahu's. So that we, a number of us, met and said, look, we have to start to re-engage in resisting the occupation. We've got to come out of our torpor, out of our false hopes, unfortunately, and really re-engage. The progressive movement has to come back into action. And so we cast around, actually, for well, what do we do? What's the focus of our work? What, you know, how do we engage with Palestinians? And we went out and we talked to a lot of Palestinian activists that we know. And the issue of house demolitions came up all the time. It was an issue we were vaguely familiar with, but didn't really know very much about. And that is that Israel has a policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. In order to confine them to little islands of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and at that time Gaza, in order to leave most of the land free for Israeli annexation. So we decided we're going to set up the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. ICAHD, it's called in short, I-C-A-H-D, which is the organization that I head now. I've headed it for the last 13 years. And we focus on the issue of house demolitions, because occupation is a very abstract, big term for people. This helps people get a handle on it. There's a house demolition, there's a story, there's a family. You can photograph the bulldozers coming. Here are the soldiers coming to demolish this family's house. They're not terrorists. And that's one of the important parts of it, because Israel presents everything it does as self-defense, defense against terrorism, you know, all this. No, these people are normal people that simply want a place to live, and Israel says, no, you can't have a home. The idea being to either confine them to these islands or drive them out of the country completely. So that's an important way to get into the occupation. But at the same time, it's an important source of solidarity. We come as Israelis into the occupied territories. We work with Palestinian families and communities to rebuild homes. We raise money. That's one of the reasons why I'm here in the States on a fundraising tour. We raise money from people. And we resist the demolition of homes. We get in front of bulldozers. We chain ourselves in homes that are going to be demolished. We do that. But we also rebuild homes that have been demolished as political acts of resistance, not humanitarian. We're not the good liberal Israelis coming to help these poor Palestinians, but we're working in a political partnership against the occupation. So we do it confrontationally with the Israeli army and government. We do it during the day. We get arrested. We get arrested all the time. And we rebuild homes. We've built about 165 homes in the last 10 years. So that's 165 political acts of resistance. It doesn't mean much if it's humanitarian, because Israel's demolished more than 24,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967, since the occupation began. So if this is humanitarian, what's 165 out of 24,000? But if you think of it as 165 joint acts of resistance of Israelis and Palestinians together, then it's really a meaningful thing. And then from there, because we learn the lay of the land, we learn what Israel's intentions are, why is it demolishing homes, where is Israel going with this whole occupation, we have a very literally grounded analysis that we then bring abroad, because we believe that the occupation is not going to end internally. The Israeli public can live with the occupation. It's lived with it for 43 years now, and it's only international pressures on Israel that are in the end going to bring about a meaningful peace. So we're trying to work in Europe. We work in other parts of the world. I was just in China recently, and of course in the United States, because Israel sees the United States as the only player in town. So that it's very important, but the United States governments, whether it's Obama or Bush or Clinton or anybody else, isn't really going to be assertive on Israel. I mean, we could talk about that later, but what we have to try to do is to build a grassroots movement that demands change in American policy towards the Middle East. And what's important to bring out here is that the Israel-Palestine conflict isn't only a localized conflict between two tribes in the far-off Middle East. It impacts directly on American interests, on Western interests, on the whole global system. You know, what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iran and with Al-Qaeda, the whole alienation of the West from the Muslim world in general, all that comes directly out of the Israel-Palestine conflict. That's the symbolic epicenter. That's actually what James Baker called it, the epicenter of instability in that entire part of the world. So it's an American interest, and the interest of the grassroots as well, not to make peace only for the sake of the oppressed Palestinians, although that's a good reason too, but because this is one of the conflicts that really is impacting negatively on everything in terms of militarism and conflicts and economy and energy, and therefore we're trying to work with the American people. That's why I'm here in Seattle, to inform them and to really build a base in which you'll tell your political representatives that, look, we demand change in your policy towards Israel-Palestine, and in that way to try to create those pressures that'll end the conflict.
Yeah, you were speaking the last couple of days at the Friends of Sabeel North America conference that happened Friday and Saturday. One of the issues you brought up, one of the ideas, is the global pacification industry. I'm hoping you can talk about that. Tell us, what is that?
Right. Well, it's like I said, the Israel-Palestine conflict is a global conflict, and it impacts on the whole world system. But it's global in another sense as well. And that is that, you know, if we look at the economic and political system of the world, From what's called a world systems perspective. This is an approach that Emmanuel Wallerstein has developed, and it's a very good way of kind of looking at the way the world works. It's based on the idea that we've been living for the last 450 years or so in a capitalist system, which shouldn't be news to anyone, in which you have core countries. The core these days, because countries change, but is the United States the core, sort of the leading economic and political and military power, because those things all work together, and of course Europe, and to some degree Japan, and now you're having changes because China is arising and India is rising and Iran maybe and Brazil. So it's a very dynamic system. But right now, at least at this moment in history, you've got the United States and Europe especially as the core. And the rest of the world is the periphery. I mean, these are the people that are third world, we call them sometimes, developing countries. And the vast majority of humanity lives in this so-called periphery, in which they're expected to do three things. They're expected to provide cheap labor for Nike in Indonesia when we want to make expensive sneakers. And they're expected to be a place where we can dump our excess commodities, and because they're kind of a captive market. And they're expected to be a place where we can extract resources. And they're supposed to give us their oil and give us their timber and give us their minerals and give us their water so that you have a one-way capital flow in this world system. The United States has 5% of the world's population and it uses more than 30% of the world's resources. And the only thing the United States gives back to the world is military. I mean, you've got bases in 174 countries out of about 195. So that because you need the military in order to enforce the system, people don't get exploited voluntarily. Well, in a sense, this whole core periphery dynamic and relationship, which is one of oppression and inequality and exploitation, is exactly what you have in microcosm in Israel-Palestine. Here you've got a core country, Israel, that's on a European level. The Israeli economy is Israel's a little country, and it's always playing on the fact that we're this little country. It is a little country, but the Israeli economy is three times larger than Egypt, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon put together. So it's a major little United States in that part of the world. For 43 years now, holding more than 4 million Palestinians captive in an occupation in which we're taking their water, we're taking other resources, they become cheap labor, we want their land for all kinds of reasons. This is a population that refuses to submit. So you've had two intifadas or uprisings. You have resistance. So what Israel has to do is not only put down resistance, which is a military function, but it has to pacify the population. In other words, the idea is we're going to control this area permanently. There's no negotiations. There's no peace process from Israel's point of view. This is a permanent claim to that entire country, and the Palestinians are going to be pacified, so they can't resist. Well, that's in microcosm, like I say, the dynamic of the entire global system. So when the United States and Europe are looking around for military technologies, for technologies of security and policing, they look to Israel. I mean, no country has more experience in controlling masses of restive poor people than Israel does. So you have to look at the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza as a laboratory. Because here's where Israel's developing weaponry and tactics of what are called, and we're not really aware of, I think, the implications of these terms, called counterinsurgency. You know, we've made, you know, the powers that be have captured the language, which is one way in which they pacify us. In other words, if you go out in the street here in Seattle and you ask people who are the insurgents, they'll tell you they're the bad guys. The insurgents are the bad guys, you know. So we've made, you know, the insurgents are Al-Qaeda, the insurgents are whoever's in Iraq and so on. But wait a minute, wasn't Paul Revere an insurgent? In other words, somehow we've taken the people, insurgents are the people, resisting oppression, exploitation, and we've made them the bad guys. And the states that have always been oppressive and representing very small classes of capital and so on, they become the good guys. And there's a clash of civilization, and the rich capitalists are on the civilized side, and the peoples of the world, the vast majority of people of the world, are the insurgents. They're the bad guys. So it's a very sophisticated way of even controlling language and the way we look at the world. Well, Israel does that. No country has succeeded more than Israel, than selling. Here, Israel has an occupation of 43 years. Massive violations of human rights, massive violations of international law, oppression, killing. I mean, the invasion of Gaza that we just saw last year with everything that was going on there. Defiance of dozens of UN resolutions. I mean, many more UN resolutions than Saddam Hussein ever defied. All of this going on, and yet Israel has absolutely almost unanimous support in Congress. When they had a resolution last November in Congress, you know, the Goldstone Committee under the UN put out a report about what Israel did in Gaza and accused Israel of war crimes. And Goldstone is a Jewish South African judge who says he's a Zionist. He has a daughter living in Israel. He's on the board of the Hebrew University. I mean, this guy couldn't have more credentials than he does. And he came out with this extremely powerful report accusing Israel of war crimes. So you have all of that, and yet, you know, last November, Congress passed a kind of a sense of Congress resolution demanding of the president that he and his government absolutely veto any discussion of the Goldstone Report in the UN. Not even allow it to be. And this was passed, this idea that we're going to completely just can the Goldstone Report in order to protect Israel. It was passed by a vote of like 430-5. So you've got almost wall-to-wall bipartisan support for Israel. So if Israel succeeds in selling this terrible occupation of all these years with all the suffering and the violence to the American Congress and the American people, well, that's So the United States can learn a lot from that. How can we sell our system of control in Iraq and everywhere else to the people? You know, in other words, the United States has a lot to learn from Israel from the point of view of framing conflicts, from the point of view of weapons that are developed, from the point of view of tactics. And what's happening here, I don't want to go on too long, but make it a lecture, but one more point of this, and that is that what's happened in 9/11 is the blurring of three spheres that were very distinct: military, internal security, and policing. These were always, you know, your police forces were more local, the CIA was different from the FBI, the military was different from the police. With the development of what's called Homeland Security, which is one of the largest government departments now, you've got almost 200,000 people in Homeland Security, it links all of those spheres. So now, in a sense, what it's done is it's brought the world into Seattle. So now the military that's involved in counterinsurgency in Iraq and learning from Israel in Gaza is taking that weaponry of counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, urban warfare, and taking the tactics it learns on the Palestinians. The Palestinians are like the guinea pigs, or the people of Iraq and Afghanistan are guinea pigs, and bringing those approaches into your local community through your police force. I mean, it's one old boys network, old boys group, you know, military, security, and policing. The police aren't as individuals aren't guilty really, but I mean, who are the police? They're ex-military for the most part. So it's one old boys network. So that this is a real danger to civil liberties, and that's one of the things we're trying to point out to Americans, that there's what's called this the Israeli pacification industry, in which Israel the Israeli economy is based on exporting the occupation. We're exporting weapons. Israel's the third largest arms exporter in the world. And little Israel exports more arms than Britain or China. It's the third largest arms exporter in the world. The United States is number one. You guys have won hands down. And then there's Russia, and France and Israel are tied for number three. So it's exporting arms, making a lot of money from arms, exporting these approaches of counterinsurgency, working with local police forces all over the world. And so in a sense, we really have to be aware of the fact that this exporting of the Israeli occupation outward has not only a global effect from the point of view of the United States taking these tactics and weapons and using them in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and so on, but also that they're being used internally. For example, Israel has basically taken over the security of many American airports. LAX, you had the mayor of Los Angeles and half the city council coming to Israel last year to sign Israeli firms on taking over control of LAX. And Israel works intimately with local police forces. And I challenge your listeners, whether it's here in Seattle or listeners in other places, to go to your local police force and ask them, what relations do you have with the Israeli military, with the Israeli police? You know, are you learning tactics? Is Israel bringing you to Israel in order to learn in the occupied territories how to deal with dissidents that are probably, a lot of the people listening to this program would probably fall into that category? Is Israeli technology coming into your police force here at home? I mean, I'm telling you, there's a direct relationship between Israel's occupation and what's happening in your own local community. And that's something that I think then all of a sudden people understand that this faraway conflict really isn't so far away. In a global system, these things are all, it takes a day for what happened to the people in Gaza to be imported into Seattle.
We're talking with Jeff Halper. He is the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And Jimmy Johnson, who is also with your organization, done a recent article. He mentioned specifically that Seattle was one of the cities that received training from Israel. And also he had pointed out one of the poor parts of this is that it never is reviewed by, let's say, a city council if the Seattle Police Department is going into this liaison with Israel. The other thing that you had brought up actually on Friday was that Canada had a pretty incredible, it wasn't a negotiation, an agreement with Israeli security forces. Can you talk briefly about that?
Yeah, this is important because this is a kind of politics that's called security politics. I mean, it's always been there, but it's really it developed since 9/11, and Israel's very much a part of that. And that is that in normal politics, we talk about politics, you're talking about politics that are to some degree transparent. You have congressional hearings, you have committees. If the government wants to sign a treaty with a foreign government, it does so, you know, you can see the text, it does so up front, you have oversight. If your city council decides to sign a contract with a contractor or a foreign firm or something in terms of running prisons or dealing with traffic even or whatever, policing functions, it goes through the city council. And not everybody cares. I mean, if it's not transparent, it's more because people don't really dig enough to find out, but it's there. That's normal politics. Security politics, you know, the whole nature of security is a secret. And it should be secret. This is part of that reframing because we're dealing with bad guys and, you know, we can't let our hand, you know, show our hand. And, so the police forces and the, security firms and the army and so on are doing all these secret covert things, and they should and they have to do it that way, and we shouldn't have to know and we have to trust them. Well, I don't have to tell people how much you should trust governments. I mean, you know, I.F. Stone used to say that all governments lie. You don't trust any of them. So that's the problem with security politics, is that all these very important elements that have to do with civil liberties go out of the public gaze. So, for example, Israel signed about a year and a half ago what's called the Canadian-Israel Public Safety... There's no word for it. It wasn't an agreement. It wasn't a treaty, because then it would have to go through the normal channels and have parliamentary oversight in Canada. So first of all, it was public safety. Public safety means domestic. Public safety is prisons, it's police, it's borders, it's immigration, it's those kinds of things. So all of a sudden, and countries are always very reluctant and even resistant to having foreign countries come into their intimate domestic spheres. You know, this whole, the phrase that we all know, you know, about the, this is tampering in our internal affairs. You know, but this is our, you know, countries don't like to do that. All of a sudden, with the security thing, countries like Israel are able to penetrate. They're invited in. So the Canada-Israel public safety thing was simply an agreement signed by the Internal Security Minister of Canada with the Internal Security Minister of Israel. Went through no parliamentary committees. It was, you know, nobody knows what it is exactly. But it brings Israel into, for example, running Canadian prisons. And again, who's better at running a prison than Israel? Gaza is the largest prison in the world. You know, using Israeli, again, kinds of tactics of control, weapons of control. Israel's getting involved with border controls in Canada, with immigration issues, with crime issues. In other words, Israel's bringing what it learned in Gaza and the West Bank right into the life of Canadian citizens with no oversight, and working with local police forces. And the same thing is happening here. For example, in, you know, just the best example here in Seattle is Boeing. I mean, Boeing is building the wall. It's not exactly a wall. It's called a smart fence on the border with Mexico. This whole wall that Bush approved and Obama has not, unfortunately, has not ended that project. But Boeing is building it together with Elbit Systems. Elbit Systems is an Israeli, a very large, sophisticated Israeli firm that specializes in surveillance. Lenses and cameras and sensors. You have Elbit Systems in your Star Wars satellites, spy satellites in outer space. So it's Boeing and Elbit together that are building this wall on the border of Mexico. So that the danger of this security politics is that it comes into your community. There's no oversight. People aren't aware of it. And in a way, and that's where the framing comes in, people actually, it's fine with them because they believe that this is good for their security. And Benjamin Franklin once said, you know, that a people that trades its freedom for its security, it doesn't deserve either one. And I think that that's a very relevant way to look at it. You know, the Americans have to be very, you know, you're so concerned with your civil liberties and you're free, and freedom is the essence of America, and yet you're really allowing, through this uncritical, non-transparent security politics, you're really allowing some very dangerous elements into your local communities, and with no discussion.
Another of the subjects you had touched upon in your talk on Friday was continuing with the technology, and obviously what ties a lot of these security systems together is computers and, mm-hmm. and high tech, which Israel is at the cutting edge on. Right. And you had mentioned, and I quote, that we must have hundreds of Israeli military high-tech people here in Seattle working in software high-tech industry?
Yeah, I mean, Israel is one of the leaders of high-tech applications. For example, your USB stick that you stick in your computer, that's an Israeli invention. I mean, Israel is, you know, Intel has three research and development branches, the Silicon Valley, Ireland, and Israel. And there's a part of the Silicon Valley, it's funny, but it's ominous. There's a part of the Silicon Valley that's called Humus Valley, because this is where the Israeli high-tech people in the Silicon Valley have their own neighborhood. And Israel is extremely tied in. That's one of the foundations of the Israeli economy. The Israeli economy is arms, security. 60% of Israeli firms export in the area of security. And diamonds, actually. And Israel has no diamonds. It refines, distributes. And that gets Israel into a lot of the criminal elements in West Africa, in the Congo, Sierra Leone, Liberia. I mean, that's another story, but it's an important part of the whole thing. At any rate, so Israel specializes in high-tech, and high-tech is military. I mean, with all due respect to Bill Gates and Microsoft and everybody else, it's military. That's where the money is. The Pentagon has today, people don't know this, but it's true, it has today budgeted, not a proposed budget, the budget of the Pentagon that's been approved is $1.4 trillion for the development of new weapon systems over the next 20 years. Now, that's not the production of weapons, that's the development. And weapons development is high-tech stuff, all these fancy kinds of systems. So if you have, if Israel has a privileged access to American military technology, that's really what's important, because Israel is then able to be like a surrogate to the United States and spread these technologies all over the world and help the United States develop technology, because Israel has a hands-on 40-some-year experience with a high-tech occupation. So, for example, Israel is the world's leader in the military applications of nanotechnology. Now, a nano is a billionth of a meter. A nano is a molecular scale. We know nanotechnology in a benign form from biomedical research, where they put these tiny, like, for example, monitors in your veins to monitor the circulation of blood. So you can imagine, take $1 trillion through Intel and Microsoft and all these high-tech companies and use that $1 trillion to develop weapons that are molecular in size, and then get them into your police force for dealing with suspects, security stuff, immigrants, prisoners, dissidents, you know. Wow, that gets to be a pretty scary phenomenon. So that, so that's in a sense one of the things we're trying to point out, is that high tech is not just PCs. High tech is really military, and again, Israel combines this very sophisticated high tech knowledge with a groundedness in terms of how can you use it in order to control millions of people. And it's that kind of unholy combination of forces, you know, that when you link it to, yeah, I mean, Obama just signed a few weeks ago the largest Pentagon budget in history. You have, this year, the Pentagon has a budget of about $680 billion. Wow. I mean, that's for, so this military thing, especially when it gets, again, into the domestic spheres, with the idea of controlling the peripheries and occupied territories, is really something that people should be aware of. And, you know, I have a criticism of the left or the progressive community here in the United States in that it's very concerned with very important issues. I mean, there's issues of Iraq, and there's a strong anti-war movement. And issues of, you know, and then more domestic things. There's women's issues that are important, health issues, community issues, the environmental issue. These are all important. But what's missing completely, like a black hole, is any kind of systematic looking at either the military. The United States pumps about $30 billion a year of new arms into the world system. And a third of that goes to the least developed countries of the world. So you're fueling conflicts all over the world. And that's not an issue that the left has dealt with at all. Or the issue of security politics. What's going on inside your police force? Not only in terms of the African-American population and immigrants and the poor peripheral people in this country, but also in terms of the wider danger of threats to civil liberties. All this kind of security politics, military stuff, is not at the forefront of the progressive agenda. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make and encourage people to begin to look into this stuff.
Another of the specific technologies that we can see going from the battlefield and the lab there in the occupied territories is UAVs, drones.
That's right.
I think we're just starting to see their application and purchase by local police departments here in the United States.
That's right. I mean, Israel is the world's leader in drone technology, UAV drone technology. The American drones, the Predator drones that are now over Pakistan in particular, that are taking a greater and greater role in warfare, are largely based on Israeli technologies. I mean, you know, and then this really, what you're just saying, gets into this whole area of how of the interweaving of the military and domestic. Brazil was chosen as a site of the Olympics in, I don't know when, 2012 or something? Whatever. But Brazil's going to be the site of the next Olympics. I mean, within a week, the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, was in Rio, or Brasilia, whatever, signing a contract, and Brazil bought something like 340 drones from Israel. Mexico has bought drones for its police department, not for its military. The United States has bought drones. So that, you know, there's a very interesting, and Jimmy Johnson that works with us that you mentioned wrote a very interesting article. There's a whole concern now about mega events, like mega sports events, Olympics, or other kinds of mega events in which you need stadiums and you need, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are coming to your city, and these mega events inevitably work against the poor people. You have to displace, I mean, from Seoul, Korea in the Olympics, from Beijing, from all over the world, the first thing that's done is you have to displace poor people. So tens of thousands of poor people are taken out of their neighborhoods or their shanty towns and thrown out to the periphery. So you have now, you can build the stadiums and the swimming pools and the whole infrastructure. And then, of course, you've got to make your city safe for all these visitors. I mean, coming into Cape Town, South Africa, you know, for the World Cup in soccer, or going into Rio. I mean, Rio, in a way, is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. How do you make Rio safe for Americans coming down to the Olympics that would just want to have a good time? Well, so you begin to have a real war, a domestic war on the poor people. And on, I mean, you know, it's presented in terms of criminal stuff, but, you know, it's criminalizing. That's one of the problems. When you get policing functions defining what are really social policies towards poor people, you begin to criminalize the poor people. So when the poor are fighting for decent housing, when the poor are poor and sometimes they engage in criminal activities, or when the poor try to organize in terms of labor or whatever, whenever you have resistance, and the poor people, just like in the periphery, in your own cities, the poor people are going to resist. If you simply criminalize that and simply make it a policing function, you not only don't deal with their grievances, but they become the bad guys again. They become like the insurgents. So that's a real danger. And these drones that are used in Pakistan are now being used in Rio against poor people. It's a perfect example of that slippery slope from the military to your local populations. So I think the drone is a very good thing to look at to really show how, because it's become now a favorite instrument of police forces all over the world. And of course, for most people, it doesn't have a particularly sinister image. A drone, you know, you think maybe of a unmanned vehicle that's looking at traffic patterns, you know, it seems kind of neutral in a way. It's not a dangerous kind of, but it really, you know, drones now have a capacity for surveillance and a capacity for shooting that it's a mixture of spy satellites and jet fighters. So it's a very deadly and very dangerous machine when you bring it into your local cities.
And as the U.S. Drone program, you can have people literally on the other side of the planet running the drone.
That's right.
So, talk a bit about the concept of warehousing.
I think warehousing is a very important concept. And Naomi Klein talks about it. There's a very interesting fellow who's written some good books named Mike Davis, who wrote a book called Planet of Slums. Warehousing is a term that began with prisons. The fact that prisoners are warehoused, and that's it. They're put away, you throw away the key, nobody cares, nobody sees them. I mean, that's, again, an interesting thing. Prison, I know there are some groups that deal with prisoners' rights or prison reforms, but that's not a big issue. Even in the progressive community. So that, you know, you're out of sight, out of mind, and locked away permanently. So, the United States, again, has 5% of the world's population and a quarter of the world's prisoners in prisons. And I don't have to get in to prove to people that there's a direct correlation between economic and racial backgrounds in becoming a prisoner. I mean, Michael Moore, I think his best movie was Roger and Me, his first, about what happened to Flint, Michigan when GM moved its plants down to Mexico. And all of a sudden, you've got this huge rise in law enforcement expenses. They built a new state-of-the-art prison in one of the most oppressed cities in the United States. People are thrown out of their houses. It's the criminalization of poverty, of people that were working people. All of a sudden become criminals and get thrown out of their houses because they can't afford the rent. In other words, that's really, I think, even in this context, I think Roger and Me has more relevance, and it shows these relationships than it did when it was made. So that's where warehousing comes from. The idea that you just lock people away in prisons. And then it was expanded to poor people. You know, you got poor people in ghettos and they're out of sight and you don't go into those kinds of ghettos, those poor areas. But it's been expanded out before, you know, beyond that to entire continents. I mean, Africa in some ways, the entire continent is being warehoused. In other words, warehousing, and this is a very, how's this for a concept? The capitalist system, more and more, and you see it all the time, is based on a thin stratum of people making a lot of money, and they need a certain more middle class people to do the work and the marketing and all that kind of stuff, and a fairly thin stratum today of workers, because everything is automated or digitalized, or you get your sweatshops out in the periphery, so you have all that cheap labor. So that the capitalist system, so let me put it this way, the majority of the people of the world, which is, you know, 3 billion people or so, 4 billion people, can be called surplus humanity. How's that for a concept? In other words, these are people in the periphery especially, but you also have them within your country here. These are people that the system doesn't need. They're superfluous. They'll never be educated. They'll never be skilled. They'll never even be really consumers, because the market is big enough that you can exclude those people for the most part. And so what do you do with them? You know, they're going to be poor and unemployed and uneducated forever. What are you going to do with them? Well, you have to warehouse them. That's where that, in other words, that's a permanent state that they're going to be in. You have to isolate them from your society, you know, and that's the problem with security, because with 9/11, what you showed was the people of the periphery are able to penetrate the core. They're not there anymore, but they're coming to our, so, you know, how do we gate? How do we create a gated community in the West, in a sense, in the core? How do we gate the core off from all these other people? So that's warehousing. And it's a very hard concept. And I think, you know, I was just speaking in a church yesterday. I think the whole concept of surplus humanity and warehousing are the theological concepts today. You can't talk about religion or justice or rights or any kinds of values today without dealing with surplus humanity. That's I think the central ethical, moral, political concept we should be dealing with. So that what's happening is that the majority of people of the world are being warehoused. And here again is where Israel comes in. I mean, I'm not saying Israel runs the world, but that Israel has that high-tech experience, again, of controlling millions of people in the occupied territories. So that Israel has succeeded to a large degree in warehousing the Palestinians. In the attack on Gaza last year, there were protests all over the world about Israel's invasion of Gaza and the terrible things that you saw on television and so on. There were no protests in the West Bank because both the Israeli military and now the Americans with General Keith Dayton have trained a Palestinian militia to keep control in the West Bank, so that with these two levels of an Israeli and Palestinian militias controlling the people of the West Bank, they weren't allowed to protest. You had 350 protests in the United States over the invasion of Gaza, and nothing among Palestinians in the West Bank. Not because they didn't want to protest, but because they were living under these layers of oppression, in a sense, and weren't able to. So Ehud Olmert, who was the prime minister at that time, crowed very proudly at the end. He said, "You see, protests all over the world and nothing in the West Bank. We've pacified the West Bank. Now, if we can just pacify Gaza, somehow get Hamas out of there or destroy Hamas and pacify Gaza, we're home free. Because once people are pacified, nobody cares anymore. It's just like prisoners in prison. I mean, they're not on nothing's happening. They're not news. They're not in the papers. Nobody cares. You know, out of sight, out of mind." So that if Israel can help the United States and the other core countries replicate its successful pacification of the Palestinians on a global scale, and that's where all these technologies again come in of control, plus framing. So the people that are being warehoused, they're the people that are the problems and not us. Then it's a very chilling kind of a scenario, but that's where I think the capitalist system is going. It's going less towards the traditional expansion of the whole idea of the capitalist system was that more and more people would be brought in as the system expands and as you need consumers. But that's not the case. In fact, the capitalist system is today contracting and becoming much more because of high tech. You don't need workers anymore the way you did, and you can get huge profits. And people, I mean, there's something like 130 time difference between the rich people in the United States and the middle class people. Even, I mean, the income disparities are tremendous. So you're getting this smaller and smaller circle of very rich people and a small circle of middle class people located largely in the core, and everybody else is permanently peripheralized and warehoused. So these are all processes that affect your own society. that I think have to be looked at more and more by the... That's why Naomi Klein is so great, because she is really not only looking at this stuff, but writing it in a way that's accessible to people and going out and speaking. But I'm trying to put the Israeli occupation piece into it, because I think that's an important part of it.
We've been talking a lot about Israel doing specific things and then the United States. We've got about 8 minutes left. And when you say Israel, what do you specifically mean? Is it the government of Israel? Is it corporations within Israel? What is that?
Well, that's an important question, because I don't want to demonize Israel or anybody else. I mean, it's a good cautionary tale, because in fact, I think the high majority of Israeli Jews do not want the occupation. They never bought into it. You have maybe there's 5.5 million Jews in Israel. And there's maybe 40,000 of the crazy settlers that we know of from television. You know, the religious Jews that say the West Bank is the land of Israel and it belongs to us and we got to get the Arabs out. And the people that Israel got out of Gaza, you see on TV sometimes fighting with these crazy settlers. So that if they're 40,000 out of 5.5 million, it means that the Israeli Jewish public never really bought into the occupation. It never bought into the idea of Sharon and Begin, that this is the greater land of Israel and it has to be ours. Israelis, in many ways, are normal people. They have their country. They want to live in their country. And but they've been, in a sense, silenced and co-opted by the political and military leadership. So that you have an occupation now of since 1967... And what the political leadership has done has succeeded in neutralizing the opposition of the Israeli public. In other words, today there's no more terrorism, let's say. And terrorism is also a loaded term. Because, you know, what about state terrorism, which is much bigger than the so-called terrorism from below that we talk about. States are somehow left out of the equation. But at any rate, there's no more attacks. Israelis are feeling very secure. The economy is doing great. Again, partly because we're profiting from the occupation in terms of all the military technology and the experience and the know-how that we're exporting. The Israeli, even though there's criticism of Gaza, the Israeli status in the international community is very good. Congress loves Israel. The United States is Israel's best friend. Europe is very pro-Israeli and so on. So in a sense, the Israeli people are saying, and this is the problem, we don't like the occupation. We don't really want an occupation. But, you know, we can live with it. As long as our political and military leaders say we need an occupation, we need to be there, but they can protect us, it becomes a non-issue. That's the biggest problem. When the controlling of millions of surplus humanity becomes a non-issue. So Israelis don't hate Arabs. They don't hate Palestinians. There's no active emotion. If they hated the Arabs, I could work with that. But when a people simply write off another people and say, we really don't care because they're not affecting us. And that's what the Israeli military has succeeded in doing, is pacifying the Palestinian population to a point where it's irrelevant to us. And we're able to use the territories for our benefit, but it doesn't penetrate into our society. So it's not an issue. Not that the Israelis are bad people. Not that they want an occupation. Not that they hate Arabs. But it doesn't matter to them. The occupation is as far away from Israel as Thailand. It's just, they don't care anymore. And they don't have to care. So again, if you take that situation and you magnify it globally, so that here in the United States, what's happening to the surplus humanity of the world isn't really an issue because it's not in our local community and we're not affected by it, then the whole system is perpetuated in that sense. And that's why what I'm trying to say, and I'm trying to sort of, I'm talking about a global Palestine. So I'm trying to say from our experience in Israel-Palestine, you know, this is really relevant to you in Seattle and to your listeners in other places, and let's start to connect the dots in a way that hasn't really been done before.
How can people support your organization, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions?
Well, we have a website. It's ICAHD.org. It talks about what we do. Of course, we can always use financial support, because as a grassroots and political and sort of, I would say, we use the word left in Israel. You don't use it so much in the States. Organization, we're dependent on funding from people. So that's one way to support us. But the other way is to be in touch with us, and again, to on one level, to help us get the information about the occupation out to the wider public, so that we can begin to create that pressure from below on members of Congress, on the American government, to take steps to end the Israeli occupation. But beyond that, to think together with us, what are the elements of this occupation that's coming into our country? Like I said, the militarism, the policing, the issue of dangers to civil liberties, all kinds of high-tech forms of oppression. In other words, to think with us, how can we elaborate this idea of global Palestine and bring the Palestine issue home to Seattle or wherever we are, because it really is relevant to our concerns here. So we would welcome anybody being in touch with us, supporting us, seeing us as allies. We have an analysis that we're willing to share. I've written a book called An Israeli in Palestine, we see ourselves as active partners with your listeners.
With that, we are unfortunately out of time.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Okay.
We have just been speaking with Jeff Halper. He is coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and author of two books, Obstacles to Peace, A Reframing of the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, and An Israeli in Palestine, Resisting Dispossession, Redeeming Israel.